Hello, I'm Anna Maria Tremonti, and this is The Current.
Thank you so much. How do I entertain a packed house? With my new Electrolux appliances. Now I can cook the roast for the dinner party and the mac and cheese for the sleepover. Simmer the chocolate sauce, toss Jack his toy, serve the gummy bears, then the apple juice at the perfect temperature, be the charming co-host, clean the stemware perfectly, and end the night looking for monsters under the bed. Introducing Electrolux with wave touch controls and an induction hybrid cooktop that boils water in 90 seconds. You can be even more amazing.
Well, that's the ubiquitous Kelly Ripa, Regis Philbin's co-host on the U.S. daytime program Regis and Kelly's Show, the modern-day superwoman in commercials for household products. In those commercials, Ms. Ripa successfully juggles work and family and looks great doing it. She's the effortless host of lavish dinner parties, the happy wife of a square-jawed husband, and the mother of cute, well-behaved kids, and she also has perfectly chiseled arms. All in all, she's pretty much guaranteed to make many women feel inadequate, angry, or maybe even unhappy. According to Betsy Stevenson and Justin Wolfers, women and girls are less happy now than their predecessors were 30 years ago, and significantly less happy than men and boys are today. This despite the long list of gains achieved by the women's movement. Betsy Stevenson and Justin Wolfers are professors of business and public policy at the University of Pennsylvania. Their new journal article is called The Paradox of Declining Female Happiness, and they're in Philadelphia. Good morning.
Good morning.
Morning.
Betsy Stevenson, before we talk about happiness today, let's go back to the beginning of the period you studied. What was the situation like for men and women 30 years ago?
So if we actually go back to the early 70s, what we find is that women were telling us that they were pretty happy. In fact, they were happier than men on average.
And how did you measure happiness?
So happiness is measured by a series of questions that ask people either how happy are they taking all things together in their life today, or how satisfied they are with their life. I mean, clearly, this is such a paradoxical finding that you wouldn't want to rely on just one survey or even one question. And so what we do is we actually look for every data set we can find that asks people about what we call more broadly subjective well-being over this period, and then we look to see if we see similar trends. And we were really surprised to find something very similar across all of these data sets, which was that women start in the 70s telling us that they're happier than men, and they end in the mid-2000s, you know, at 2005, 2006, telling us that they're less happy than men.
Mm. Okay, so Justin Wolfers, 30 years later, how happy or unhappy are women today and men today?
It really depends which country you're thinking about. The United States is actually one of the biggest puzzles. On average, Americans haven't gotten any happier over the past 30, 40 years, despite pretty amazing economic growth. But the US is the outlier. Europe, both men and women have gotten happier, although men have gotten happier faster and by more than women have. And actually, all around the world, we've looked at, in other work, 140 different countries, and all around the world, as countries are getting richer, their people are getting a little bit happier.
So what?
But what we're finding is that the women are not keeping up with the men in terms of those happiness gains. So in those countries where people are getting happier, the men are getting happier at that faster rate. And so we see women's happiness declining relative to that of men.
Now, did you study Canada as well in this particular survey?
We worked really hard to try and find data for Canada. Canada has a little bit of data on happiness, but unfortunately not enough for our purposes.
Oh, okay.
What we need is to see the evolution of happiness through time. So you need not just one or two surveys, but quite a lot of surveys, preferably, you know, every year or so. Canada has gone into the field asking about happiness maybe five or six times that we were able to find.
Okay, but given our closeness to the United States, I think we can probably draw some parallels anyway in what you found. Betsy Stevenson, does this mean there's been a tangible change in women's circumstances, or are women simply judging themselves harder?
That's the thing that's very hard for us to judge. We do what we can with the data to try to rule out certain explanations, but we really aren't able to discern between exactly the two that you just proposed. One is that we could simply have higher expectations today, and so we're judging ourselves against higher expectations. It could also be that we're just finding it difficult to juggle all the different things And it could, you know, even be something that when what we say when we ask how happy we are, when we're asked how happy we are, what we're saying today or the question we're answering today is very different from the question we were answering in the 70s. And one thing we did find in the United States was that how when you're asked more generally how happy you are, that that was much more correlated with your marital happiness in the 70s than it is today. And so it may be that today's answer about happiness is a more holistic measure of different aspects of one's life. And that just might make it a different question.
The other thing is women's lives and men's lives are also very different today. So 30 or 40 years ago, many of the people that a typical woman would interact with during a day would be other women, potentially other housewives. Today, maybe she's interacting with men at the office and maybe with a guy in the corner office. Maybe that makes things a little bit more salient. She understands that that corner office maybe should have been hers, and maybe that was simply a thought that wasn't that obvious 30 or 40 years ago.
Yeah, when you compare yourself to somebody else to see if you're happy, there's a wider number of people to compare yourself to, is what you're saying.
Not just a wider number, but also a wider variety of roles that they're playing, some of those that maybe women were shut out of in the past. You know, a comparison I like to think about, how happy do you think Geraldine Ferraro was? She was shattering that final glass ceiling when she was running for the second highest office in the United States. How happy do you think Hillary Clinton was when she failed to shatter the highest glass ceiling? These women came to very similar roles in some respect with very different sets of expectations. Ferraro, I'm sure, was thrilled. Clinton, I'm sure, was disappointed.
So for some, the first thing that comes to mind when they hear the results of a study is the idea of another overburdened working mother. But your study does look at females across the spectrum. And what did you discover?
We did try to look for, you know, this basic explanation of a woman struggling to balance work and small children. And so we looked at these trends, breaking women into different categories, comparing single mothers with married mothers, working mothers with stay-at-home mothers, people with no children versus people with children. And what we found was that there weren't any differences. These declines in women's happiness relative to men in the same situation were occurring equally among all the groups. And there wasn't, you know, you can't point to something like, oh, it's women in the prime age of life when they're balancing the decision about having children and having a career. It's not even, there's not even differences by age for women. We see that all women have gotten less happy, both absolutely and relative to men. And so those simple explanations can be ruled out. We looked at a survey that involved teenage girls. And that survey points to the fact that there might be something going on with work-family balance, but we need to rethink what work-family balance is about, because it's not about necessarily balancing having your children with having a career, but thinking about all the different things you want to accomplish in life and how you're going to balance those things. And so the teenage girls told us that they're asked how important different things are to them in life. They told us that it was more important than ever. So the growing importance over the last 35 years of being a leader in their community, of making a contribution to society, and having lots of money, being successful in their line of work. But what didn't happen was things like, you know, giving their children better opportunities didn't get less important. In fact, they also got more important. It also became more important that they stayed close to their parents and relatives, that they maintained their relationships. And so everything seems to be becoming more important to these girls, and nothing's giving. In fact, the only thing that they told us had become significantly less important to them was finding purpose and meaning in life.
That is so fascinating because, you know, we have a clip that I was going to play for you a little later, but I'm going to play it now. And this speaks to the very thing you're talking about. This is Emma Nipp. She's 15 years old. She lives in Ottawa, Ontario.
I do a lot of extracurricular activities. Badminton, soccer, dragon boat racing. I've given up synchronized swimming because it became really stressful. The training was really hardcore and rigorous. So eventually I couldn't take it anymore. I love the sport. It's a great sport, but I had too many things going on in my life right at that moment, so I had to stop. Even if I was really happy after the competition, if we did really well, which we did, I knew I had to quit or else I would go crazy. My friends, they have content lives. They've known each other since they were very little. And I kind of envy them in that way because I've moved around a lot in my life. So I just met them in grade 5. They've known each other since they're in kindergarten. And they seem to have like the best life, in my opinion. I'd like to stay in one place and have like a great circle of friends and a great job and a dog. I always have to be busy though, because if I'm not busy, then I'm unhappy. But if I'm too busy, then I'm happy. I need to find the right balance.
Okay, that's a 15-year-old looking for the right balance. She seems to speak to everything you said the survey told you.
I mean, I just found that clip astonishing. We were able to draw our conclusions from the analysis of 450,000 survey respondents. And that young woman, I think, spoke to the concerns that came out of those hundreds of thousands of responses.
And the one thing that they said when we're, you know, asking them how satisfied they are with things, what we found was that the girls had become less satisfied with their life as a whole these days. But they really point to one thing that's missing. And what's missing is the amount of fun they're having. They're satisfied and happy with things like their educational experiences, with their relationships with their parents, with their standard of living. But they're just not happy with things like their leisure time. You know, that girl spoke to crowding herself with all of these activities and not leaving herself time just to hang out.
Why do you think that is, that level of, you know, concern and that discontent then at such an age?
I mean, there seems to be an extraordinary intensification, I guess, of all aspects of the lives of young adults. I mean, one of the other things that I think is important to throw into the mix here is, as much as, you know, think life is becoming a lot more intense, and the young women are less happy, particularly than young men. If you ask them whether you would rather be a woman today or a woman 30 or 40 years ago, overwhelmingly they would answer they'd rather be a woman today. So, you know, life is more intense, but that turns out to be a good thing here.
It's really interesting. I want to bring another perspective into the conversation. I have a clip of a woman named Reva Seth. She is the author of First Comes Marriage, Modern Relationship Advice from the Wisdom of Arranged Marriage. And this is what she had to say when she heard about your study.
I think especially around the idea of romantic love and what we're looking for from our relationships and from our partners, we've never had more unrealistic expectations than we do now. And for my book, I actually interviewed over 300 women from Canada, the U.S., the U.K., and from across Europe about their decision to have an arranged marriage. And I noticed that consistently that the women I was speaking to, whether they were my age in their 30s or my mom's age in their 50s, they seemed overwhelmingly happy and really contented, especially compared to what I consider to be the environment of general relationship angst that surrounds us as a society. Women today have more options than ever before, which is fantastic. We don't need a husband or a partner to have a family for financial support or for any of the other traditional roles. And while that's fantastic and it should be really freeing for women, we've instead replaced it with an even heavier onus on finding our soulmate.
Okay, Justin Wolfers, what do you think about what Reva Seth is saying there?
It's a mixed bag. But let me put the positive on this. What a wonderful world we live in, that what we're looking for is fulfillment in our relationships rather than looking for yet another breadwinner.
You know, I hear a lot of people talk about this, the search for, you know, too much out of their individual relationships. This is just not my area of expertise, although personally I would say that I did that and it's made me ecstatically happy. And, you know, Justin and I are also a couple.
I was going to say, you two are partners in work and life, right?
She has to say it. I'm across the table from her right now.
Well, since we're talking about you two, can I ask, how did you measure on that scale? As you looked at that survey, did you say, you know, I see this trend of women being less happy and I don't feel that way? Or did you say, even though I have what I consider to be a good life, I can relate to why they're not as happy as they were 30 years ago?
What you want to do is compare yourself to your mother, you know, when she was at this point in her life, your grandmother, and ask, am I happier than my mother would be or my grandmother would be? And our lives are very different. And frankly, I wouldn't change my life for my mother's life or for my grandmother's life. But I can imagine, you know, that, you know, say my grandmother, particularly at my age, I'm in my mid-30s, you know, she would have had older children, whereas I'm pregnant with my first. She would have had a husband whose career was much farther along and she was really enjoying playing a part of that career. My grandfather was a a diplomat. And so, of course, the diplomat's wife has a big role to play. So I think she was quite content with what she was doing. But that said, I know my grandmother's always taken some pride in the amount of money she earned when she did work, supporting her siblings during the Great Depression. And she was a very ambitious, intelligent woman. And I think if she was growing up today, she would have been happier having more choices.
Justin, has this research changed your relationship in any way?
Fortunately not, because we're empiricists, so I get to say that we're just one data point among 5 billion, and we neither falsify nor prove any particular hypothesis.
Okay, well, fair enough. What you're talking about brings me to yet another clip. I have a clip of a woman who got in touch with you during a call-in program that you did on a U.S. radio show. She talked about having been part of the women's liberation movement several years ago, but had clearly changed her mind about some things. And let's listen to that.
You know, I live with all this, to me, immorality when I look back at it. And I thought, wow, you know, what the heck's going on here? I mean, you know, the breakdown of the family, our morals today. I mean, no wonder we're unhappy. I mean, I was married like, you know, 2-3 times, meant nothing to me. Men are men, women are women, but no, women's lib. We tried to be men. We're unhappy. I want to be a woman. I want to be a mother. I want to be home. You know, I've always wanted to be that. And I'm happy to be a woman. Now I feel my place.
I'm just wondering, does she speak to your research? Is she misconstruing things?
I think, one of the things we try and do as empiricists is be very clear about how far the data can take us. And the fact is that over the past 40 years, women's measured happiness has fallen in the United States, and it's risen for men a little bit. So there's a very legitimate interpretation of this. We call it the Rush Limbaugh interpretation, and this is, in fact, Rush Limbaugh and many conservatives' favorite interpretation of the research, that what this proves is that the women's movement was dreadful for women. Now, that's one interpretation. A different interpretation is what this proves is that it's a silly enterprise to try and measure happiness. Everyone knows women have become happier, and if the data tell you otherwise, the data may be broken. A different interpretation would be what it proves is, you know, we know that women's lib was terrific for women, but something else must have happened that has been really difficult for women. And we've talked about some of those possible explanations, things like work-life balance, the intensification of life, things like that. All of these are open questions, and so, you know, I'm not sure I share the caller's interpretation, but it's not one that I think as a social scientist I can say is definitely wrong.
Mm-hmm. It's up to us then to take your statistics and try to figure out what they mean. It's not up to you to tell us to impose an interpretation with your findings.
I'm taking the wimp's way out. Betsy's a little braver than me, though.
So Betsy, go ahead.
I want to address really literally her point, which was she said, look, we stopped taking marriage seriously, and I've been divorced. I think she said she was divorced 2 or 3 times.
She did, yeah.
I'm sort of surprised she doesn't know how many. But what I would have expected to see if that were the case, first of all, would have been big differences by marital status, which we didn't see. But second of all, I would have expected to see a decline in happiness that was really sharp in the 70s and then stopped, because that's what happened with the divorce pattern. And we don't see that kind of peaking decline in happiness and then the reversal occurring in any way that matches the trends in divorce.
Hmm. And Justin, across North America, the gap between rich and poor has increased. Real wage growth has stagnated. Are there consequences of that for women in particular?
The financial satisfaction of women has worsened relative to that of men. Now, this may actually be they're increasingly, you know, picking up the checkbook and actually taking a role in the family's finances. It's no longer the husband's job to shield his wife from those pressures. And, you know, those pressures aren't fun. None of us enjoy balancing the checkbook.
There is certainly seems to be some evidence that women are taking on increasing portion of the financial burden in the household, and that's being reflected in their satisfaction with their family's finances. And that, in you know, this is one aspect in which men have been the beneficiaries of the women's movement. Real wages of men without a college degree have been falling over this period, but that's not what's been happening to household income, because their wives have gone into the labor force. And, you know, how much of that benefits women relative to men, it's hard for us to know if we look at the the happiness data, it looks like men might have gotten some of those gains.
You actually make this point, too, with women's sexual freedoms as well, that perhaps men have benefited more from all of the greater choices that women have.
Crikey, for some reason, Betsy just pointed at me and said, you take that one. The two great technological changes through this period have been the pill and the legalization of abortion. The pill has been wonderful for women, allowing them to control when it is that they want to get pregnant, and therefore allowing them to do things like decide it's worth getting an education because they're going to be able to time their pregnancies in a way that also allows them to pursue professional careers. But it's also been terrific for men. The literal availability of sex and sex outside of marriage, turns out there's two people in most sexual acts, and both of them have been enabled by the pill.
It's really fascinating. That the movement, quote-unquote, could actually have benefited men more.
I mean, this is a very important theme. We're economists studying often the economics of the household. People live in households, and a lot of the time when we think about something as having affected men or women, what they've done is they've changed the choice set for the household. And then there's a second question, then, you know, so the household as a whole is better off. There's a second question as to who is it within the household who's going to, you know, the pie just got bigger, who's going to get the extra slice? And that's sometimes a separate question. But just simply the theoretical insight there that it may be that we do things that are pro-women, but that men end up getting a lot of the benefits from.
Well, it's interesting, too, because if we go back to that little clip of the commercial with Kelly Ripa at the beginning, that sort of speaks, it's almost like a retro commercial, right? That's like from the 50s, not 30 years ago, but 50 years ago, of the perfect wife who can do everything in the home and still, you know, she can juggle all of those things. And that also might speak to the freedoms, but we still tie them to sort of the traditional expectations.
So when you started playing that commercial, I was confused as to whether it was a commercial from the 50s or a modern commercial. And then I was listening to all the features of the vacuum. I was like, no, it's definitely a modern commercial.
Now, it's interesting, because it does sound like something out of the past.
You know, it points to women taking on more things without getting rid of other things. You know, and that particular commercial shows all of these technological advances that have helped women continue to be a master in the home rather than, say, pulling their husband in and making it easier for their husband to do the cooking. Personally, I've spent some time in my research thinking about these technological advances. And one of the things that they've done actually is made it easier for you to diversify the tasks and to allow both husbands and wives to do work around the home, because you don't need such a specialized set of skills to run today's push-and-go washing machine versus, you know, the non-automatic washers that, say, my grandmother would have been using in the 50s, which took just a little bit more knowledge about how to do the laundry.
Mm. Now, you know, in your article, you quote a 1999 Virginia Slims poll, which found 72% of women polled believe that women having more choices in society today gives women more opportunities to be happy. And 39% thought that having more choices makes life more complicated for women. So that kind of actually meant that 2 out of 5 women see more choice in a somewhat negative light, which also, I mean, kind of dovetails with what we're talking about women coping with more choices.
Can't both be true? More choices does create greater complexity, but it also creates greater happiness. So there's certainly a cost that comes with it. But, you know, one of the other polls that we look at, you know, again, I think I mentioned this earlier, would you rather be a woman today or a woman 40 years ago? Overwhelmingly, they'd rather be a woman today. So the greater cost, the complexity of modern life appears to come with some payoff. Now, the puzzle then is that our data says that payoff isn't happiness.
So, Betsy, beyond the gender issues, what can this study teach us about happiness?
I think it actually is somewhat of a cautionary tale about using happiness data to evaluate broad social changes that themselves may actually be impacting how people answer the question. And I think that until we have more evidence on exactly why women's happiness is declining relative to men's over this period, we want to be careful in trying to use these responses to subjective well-being questions to do policy analysis. I've certainly seen a lot of researchers try to use these types of questions to figure out whether, say, universal daycare is a good idea or a bad idea, or whether or not some other policy that's supposed to improve the lives of women actually improves the lives of women. if these changes themselves are changing how people answer the question, then that might not be the best way to evaluate the policy.
It's almost as if the study could point to how maybe the next survey should be more pointed in some of its questions.
We call this the Donald Rumsfeld defense. You go to war with the data you have, not the data you want. Not just that we need more pointed questions, but also if what we're trying to do with our lives is something beyond happiness, then maybe we should be asking more questions about things like meaning or whatever else it is that we care about. Happiness is really useful. It expands the conversation beyond the typical econo-speak of raising income or GDP. But I don't think we're all the way there yet as to, you know, having measured or diagnosed the human condition.
Okay, well, maybe we should have you back as you continue to work on this.
We'll look forward to it.
Thank you for your time.
It was great talking with you.
Thanks, Anna Maria.
That is Betsy Stevenson and Justin Wolfers. They are professors of business and public policy at the University of Pennsylvania. Their article, The Paradox of Declining Female Happiness, will be published in the forthcoming issue of the American Economic Journal, Economic Policy. They spoke to us from Philadelphia. Stay with us on CBC Radio 1. Q is next. And later on The Point, meet a man in Montreal who managed to move house and home using nothing but bicycles and trailers. The Point's at 2 o'clock, 2:30 in Newfoundland and parts of Labrador. And tonight at 10 o'clock on CBC Television, watch The National with Peter Mansbridge. We're going to leave you with a little music that touches a few of the items we've been talking about today. We spoke about Ontario's plan for a full-day integrated childcare and kindergarten. We also discussed the nature of cruelty. And while this song may be cruel to Elvis fans, it's been a big hit with kids over the years. So this one goes out to the kids. Here is Daffy Duck and his rendition of The King's Don't Be Cruel. I'm Anna Maria Tremonti. Thanks for listening to The Current.
Say I do. Then you'll know you have me. And I'll know I'll have you too.
We can hit like better.
Don't be cruel to a heart that's true. Don't be cruel.